Trade Bites. Trade Bites. The podcast about trade policy.
Hello, and welcome back to a new series of Trade Bites, the podcast series now run by the Centre for Inclusive Trade Policy, and hosted by me, Chris Horseman, Deputy Editor of the Trade Policy News Service, Borderlex. Have you missed us while we've been away? Oh, I'll bet you have. Anyway, we're back with more podcasts designed to throw a constructively critical spotlight on the world of UK trade policy. And in this episode, we're getting stuck right in with the really big question. How is Brexit going? We're now 4 years on from the UK's formal departure from the EU, and it's been just over 3 years since we left the EU single market. British exporters and importers trading with the EU have faced a whole new regulatory environment since then. Most have adapted over time. Many have adapted well. But what can we say about the overall impact of Brexit on trade with our nearest and biggest trading partner? Has Brexit led to shifts in the UK's trading patterns? A pivot towards other parts of the world, to use the government's preferred terminology? Or does the gravity model, beloved of trade economists, still hold true? Britain's trade with the EU is regulated by the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, the TCA, that 2,000-page agreement that was hastily negotiated during the pandemic years. Has that proven to be a satisfactory framework for EU-UK trade? And with elections happening in both the EU and the UK later this year, might we see any kind of movement towards changes in the TCA over the next few years? Well, to get some answers to these big questions, we're lucky to have with us today an excellent panel of guests, all of whom have extensive experience in this area. I'm joined by Dr. Niccolò Tamberi, Research Fellow at the Centre for Inclusive Trade Policy. It's a pleasure to welcome Emily Fry, Senior Economist at the UK think tank, the Resolution Foundation. And a big welcome also to John Springford, Associate Fellow at the Centre for European Reform in London. Thanks to all of you for joining us today. Niccolò, if I can start with you, what are the headline figures? So how has UK trade with the EU evolved since 2021? And what can we say about how that compares with UK trade, perhaps with non-EU countries?
The evolution of UK's trade with the EU since the introduction of the Trade and Cooperation Agreement in 2021 has been quite surprising. We've seen for UK's exports to the EU a big fall in January 2021. Of about 40% as the agreement entered into force, followed by a very quick recovery and not much action thereafter. The story is a bit different if we look at imports, which were down by 20 to 30% compared to imports of the UK from other non-EU countries over the period 2021 to 22. But then by the end of 2023, the gap is now close to zero, and UK imports from the EU fully recovered relative to imports from non-EU countries. And that is, I guess, not what everybody expected. So quite a surprising result. Surely, if you look at some sectors or small firms, the story could be a bit different. But on aggregate, this is what we see in the data.
So a mystery to start us off, and I'm sure that's something that we'll be unpacking as we go on. Emily, we've been talking about trade, but just how important is trade to the UK's economic welfare? Does it actually matter whether we're exporting or importing more than we used to?
Thanks, Chris. Yes, so trade is a bit of an esoteric concept, and the UK is a pretty open economy, but what does that actually mean? So it means that we import and export a reasonably large share of our economy. And that's to be expected. We're an island, we've got relatively easy access to shipping routes, and we've got a lot of close neighbours. We're not the most open economy in the world. We have about 60% of our trade as a share of GDP. But why does it matter for the UK? So you can think about trade impacting people in Britain in two ways. So firstly, in terms of our consumption, what we're consuming from abroad and what we're consuming domestically as well, and also in terms of our production. So if we start with consumption, trade means that we can consume things that we don't necessarily have to produce here at home. So let's take food as an example. So the reason that we have so much choice about, you know, a different type of lettuce, the different types of coffee, if we only ate British produced foods, the choice would be a lot smaller. And the other finding in recent Resolution Foundation research is that actually importing these goods has actually kept the prices down for a lot of goods that we are importing. So the fact that we are able to source these goods from overseas means that we are able to actually have cheaper consumption at home. We also found that, you know, if you are a low income household or a high income household, you actually have about the same amount that you're consuming is from imports rather than domestically produced. And so this is about a third of everything that we consume is domestically produced, but that's actually increased over the last kind of 15 years from about a quarter pre-financial crisis. And that's excluding rental costs, because that's kind of the one thing that low-income households in the UK are spending quite a lot more of their incomes on than higher-income households. Then on the second side is production. So the UK sells into global markets and also gets a lot of inputs from global markets. And why do we care about that? Well, because the most productive inputs can help our industries be competitive, and we can also have a much bigger market for things that we produce domestically. If we're producing 1 million cars in the UK, you don't necessarily want to sell them all to UK consumers. You want UK consumers to have the choice of importing whatever car they want, and we can export those cars to consumers around the world. And so what's happened actually over the last 20 years or so is that the number of sectors that have had high export exposure, so your exports as a share of total supply are more than a quarter, has increased across different industries over the last 20 years. And that is mainly because of professional services sectors actually having increasing export exposure. And so that comes with some key advantages. You can have some specialization in those sectors. They can be highly productive. You can also have higher demand from overseas for what we produce. And also it's interesting in terms of workers, because these tradable jobs are typically kind of middle or highly paid. So tradable goods jobs are typically in the kind of middle to upper middle part of the pay distribution, whereas tradable services jobs are much more concentrated at the very top of the income distribution. And so it's good to have these productive jobs, but we also need to be thinking about how we're redistributing some of those gains from trade as well.
Let's try and unpack some of the trade policy impacts of this. Now, John, I think it's fair to say that not since the days of Sigmund Freud has there been quite so much interest in the concept of a doppelganger. Now, this is a concept which you devised to try and separate the effects of Brexit from the effects of the pandemic, both of which arrived at more or less the same time, and both of which obviously have trade dampening effects. Could you sort of give us the 2-minute version of how this model works and, more importantly, what it reveals?
Thanks very much, Chris. I have to say that I didn't come up with this. Must be honest about it. This is a technique which has been used increasingly across the social sciences to try and work out what the consequences of a big event have been. And the way it works is you take your country of interest, in this case, the UK, and then something big comes along like Brexit, and you see whether the UK differs from a kind of synthetic fake UK, fake in inverted commas. That fake UK is made up of countries whose economic performance, in my case, across a range of different economic indicators, has been most close to that of the UK up to the point of Brexit. And then you project forward that synthesized UK, which in the trade case is made up of the United States, bit of the United States, bit of Germany, bit of Greece, bit of Ireland, you know, so that you end up with a kind of a singular UK, which you hope doesn't have any of the effects of Brexit in it, and then compare it to the UK itself, which did, and see what the difference is. And if we apply that to trade, goods trade, then we end up with about a 10 to 15% gap between the UK and the doppelganger, which is about in line with what the gravity model implied, all of the pre-Brexit modelling implied.
So, Niccolò, you mentioned at the start that we've heard that Brexit has had a dampening effect on UK trade, and you mentioned that some sectors have been affected more than others. Which are the sectors which have been affected, and what do you think is the most likely reason why some sectors have been more affected than others?
There are essentially two sectors where we see most of the action happening, and these are agri-food and textile and clothing. I guess this is not surprising. This is where most of the trade barriers are in place, both in terms of tariffs and non-tariff barriers. And we see, for instance, for UK exports to the EU, after the introduction of the TCA, agri-food exports are down by about 20%. And this is consistent from the very beginning, from January 21 until the end of 2023. And for textile, we have a fall of about 50 to 60% of UK exports to the EU and another 20% for imports. Now, there are trade barriers, we said, which are high. There are rules of origin, which might be hard to meet for these kind of products, especially for textile and clothing, I guess. And there's a question of whether the products that are, let's say, made in the UK are really made in the UK or whether they are just imported from somewhere else. Say, for instance, you take a T-shirt from Bangladesh, put some labels on them, and then re-export them to the EU. Would that count as UK product? Well, under the previous rules, once something was inside the EU customs territory, it was free to circulate in any other country. But these days, this is not true anymore. So the sectors where we do see a big impact are these two, and it seems that these costs are here to stay.
I just wanted to come back on that and say the sectors that are affected depends on your counterfactual. So, Nicola, are you talking about a fall of 20% in food and 50% in textiles against the 2019 level?
We took data from 2017 to 2023. So we are essentially comparing here. When we look at the sectoral differences, we are using data of UK's trade and also EU's trade with the EU and with other non-EU countries. Mm-hmm. So effectively, our comparison is post-TCA compared to the period 2017 to 2020. And we try to account for any kind of shock that might have affected an importer at a particular time or an exporter at a particular time in a given sector. So that should clean our estimates from possible COVID and supply chain effects. And what it comes out is quite surprising, especially if you look at exports. You see that there were just a few sectors, especially, as I said, agri-food and textile and clothing, that were affected at the very beginning and remain affected throughout. But for imports, the story is quite different, because in 2021, the first year of implementation of the TCA, the fall was quite similar across all sectors. But as time passed, some of these sectors recovered, and what we see by 2023, really only textile and clothing remained substantially down compared to, you know, non-EU trade.
Thank you. That's really helpful. I mean, so my question about using the kind of 2017 to 2020 period or using the UK-EU versus UK non-EU trade is that there are some really messy things that have been going on, right? And the big one is COVID. And I think, Chris, you said earlier that COVID had a trade dampening effect. And that's certainly true during the period of lockdown. You know, we saw trade and all sorts of other economic indicators collapse because everybody was locked up at home. But then through the pandemic and then in its aftermath, then we saw a big trade rebound. And that's because of pent-up demand for goods during the pandemic. There was high savings, so people had lots of money to spend on things. And because people couldn't really go out as easily or were worried about it, then we saw a switch in spending from services like going to the restaurants to goods, and that raised goods trade quite a lot. So the pandemic makes it really difficult to isolate effects. But what we can do is we can compare the UK to other countries who also went through the pandemic. And, you know, sure, some did better than others, but it's a similar shock. And if we compare the UK's exports and imports, goods exports and imports, with those of EU member states. So the UK's trade with the EU and EU member states trade with each other. And then we see a very big gap build up because the goods trade rebound that we saw between EU member states is a lot higher than it was in the UK. And that's actually fairly consistent across sectors. I completely agree that agri-food and textiles are the biggest ones, but we also see some fairly large gaps in some other goods trade sectors as well, particularly, you know, kind of capital goods, so machinery and chemicals which go into making finished goods and so forth.
I think this discussion is really teasing out some of the complications that we've had with analysing the data 3 years after Brexit. The first year is obviously the pandemic. The second year, we have a huge terms of trade shock due to the Russian invasion of the Ukraine. And we're only just starting to see some of those pieces resolve themselves in the trade data. But I think John's point on comparing the UK to other countries that are a bit like the UK is a very important one, because you can see very clearly when you look at other similar countries that the UK really has diverged. And looking at this data is in terms of, from a very high level, looking at the goods and services performance of the UK. And so if we look at the goods performance of the UK compared to other G7 countries, the UK is clearly far, far behind other G7 countries, which saw this kind of post-pandemic goods boom. The UK didn't really take part in it, and its trade is now around 10% below what it was in 2019. Obviously, John would say we shouldn't be comparing to 2019. We should be comparing to where we would have been if we had grown. But I think quite comprehensively, we can say 10% below 2019 and the worst performer across these other similar-ish countries does suggest that we are not performing very well in terms of goods. What's interesting on the good side is thinking about what did the modelling say before the referendum. And so we did some modelling with the Centre for Economic Performance at LSE, and we looked at kind of what sectors did we think would be kind of worst hit in the goods space. So we expected things like cars and some of the high value added manufacturing sectors, which are in the middle of supply chains, to start untangling over kind of 15 years or so with the EU. But we also expected kind of the domestic food manufacturing industries to start growing in the UK to serve the domestic market for exactly the reason that Nicolo and John have mentioned, that we would see these kind of additional barriers for things like the food industry. And then it wouldn't actually make sense for these kind of low margin products to be trading in and out of the UK. And instead, it would make sense for the UK to kind of produce them domestically and serve the domestic market. So I think there are some kind of link ups with what we thought would happen and what is actually happening in the data now. And then on the services side, what we have seen is that, you know, we've seen this actually quite big growth in services trade. We've been performing pretty strongly compared to other G7 countries. Services is a particular comparative advantage for the UK. But I think that the fact that UK services trade is actually above its trend from 2010 to 2018. So it's above its kind of long-term trend that you would expect it to be at. So it does seem like there is some real strength there. And I think that that's something that is very interesting for us to unpack, given it's such a big part of our economy.
Emily and the Resolution Foundation's work has been great here, and they've really moved the dial, I think, because, you know, a lot of the argument before the referendum, the gravity modelling that was done was, oh, services is going to take a big hit because of a hit to the City of London, basically. And we don't seem to have seen that in the macro data. But you can tease out some Brexit hits. So compared to the 23 most advanced economies, then growth in financial services and transport services has been quite a lot slower than those other countries on average, despite particularly financial services being an area of comparative advantage for the UK. And that kind of makes sense, because those two sectors are the areas where the single market and services were most developed. Finance, because there was quite a lot of harmonisation of rules, and transport, because there were lots of barriers which were broken down to allow lorry drivers to be able to pick up loads in one country and move them to another and then on to another within the EU. And because the UK is now out of the single market, then UK lorry drivers can't do that anymore.
Okay, so we've spent a lot of time looking at the UK's relationship with the EU, but maybe we're too focused on this, because the UK government has made this very strong pivot, to use its preferred terminology, towards focusing on trade with the Asia-Pacific region. Now, this is, of course, a region whose economy is growing faster than that of the EU. It's one of the fastest growing regions of the world. So Given that fact, does the UK's strategy of doing things like joining the CPTPP, the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, does that strategy make sense?
So the geography will always matter, both in terms of economics and in terms of security. So trading with countries which are far away will never be a substitute for trading with the EU. It could be a complement. There's been a rush to sign new trade agreements as we left the EU, also to show that the new freedom in terms of policy could give real benefits for the UK. Now, rushing things is a really good idea, and negotiating trade agreements generally take years. So whether these will be good for the UK economy, we still don't know. We will see in the future. But I guess some of these new trade agreements that we signed were mostly for having a political headline. Think about CPTPP, for instance. We already had trade agreements with 9 of the 11 members. And we had to essentially accept the conditions of the deal without much negotiating powers because the deal was already set. It seems that now this rush to sign new agreements is over, and I guess that's for the best. And an evaluation of these new agreements will be possible in the future.
John, are you a fan of the Asia-Pacific pivot?
I think Nicola's right to differentiate between the economics and the politics. I mean, if we were just going straight on the economics and the politics didn't matter, then the thing to have done when leaving the EU was remain in the single market and customs union and just try and shadow EU free trade agreements that they sign. Now that we've left the single market and customs union and the political consensus seems to be we shall not rejoin, then trying to sign some free trade agreements, even if they're only going to add a few tenths of a percentage point to GDP and the loss as a result of Brexit is about 5%. It's still worth doing. But I think the key point to make is that this should not be your growth strategy. It's not going to make that much difference to growth. And people aren't really going to notice the extra pennies in their pocket that these kind of trade agreements provide.
Now, trade agreements do evolve over time, and the TCA might fall into that category potentially. There is provision for some kind of review of the functioning of the TCA in 2025, 2026, although the extent of that review clause is somewhat disputed. Emily, I wonder what you think we might expect in terms of changes or possible changes to the TCA, especially given that if there is a new government, what do you think the trade priorities should be?
I think the UK is kind of unique in our attitude to trade. We're pretty open to kind of signing new trade agreements. Each new free trade agreement was kind of celebrated as quite a sexy achievement for the government to do. And so I think that attitude puts trade as a promising lever that we should be using with other countries. You can think of this in terms of the goods and the services side, in terms of how the government should be thinking through this. So on the goods side, what does really matter, as John mentioned, is both the customs union, but also the single market for goods. And so if you join one or the other, if you have a customs union with the EU, then there's actually a lot of regulatory barriers that the UK does face in doing trade with Europe. So you might have to put a stamp on a particular kind of widget that you're selling into Europe to sell into a supply chain. You might have to combine a lot of paperwork and do a lot of form filling when you're trying to take part in some of that European trade in particular. How do you minimize this regulatory divergence from Europe? And you can take inspiration from some other countries. So if you look at somewhere like Australia and New Zealand, a smaller partner with a larger partner, if you look at Canada and the US, they have something called dynamic alignment. And so that is where the domestic regulations in Canada are on average similar to the domestic regulations in the US. And that's because Canada knows that for a lot of its industries, it has economies of scale. You need to have a big market to support particular types of industries. And you need to have that free-flowing market for your goods to be able to kind of flow across that border. And so it makes sense for a lot of things that Canada produces to just kind of have the same regulations as the US. It's a relatively high regulatory country. It's not like it's a race to the bottom necessarily in terms of regulations. And so the UK could look at thinking about how can we dynamically align some of our regulations with key industries with the EU. So things like the car industry, which is really key for Birmingham in the UK, making sure that we're really supporting particular sectors that we know have very regional impacts as well, where dynamic alignment can actually improve that relationship. But we do know that dynamic alignment alone won't necessarily remove that border. If you have a customs union too, then that can help, because a customs union is something where you can, you know, again, you'll have the same tariffs. You'd have to accept kind of all of these trade agreements that the EU has signed, but actually they're pretty similar, with the exception of CPTPP, which we were just talking about. They're pretty similar between the EU trade agreements and the UK trade agreements currently. Of course, that would mean that the UK would have less scope with things like India. And there is a discussion about an India trade deal, which could be, you know, high risk, high reward strategy for the UK, because India's economy is changing quite quickly. So depending on kind of how that moves forward, it could be a big opportunity for the UK, but it could also create some types of competition that might be damaging for the UK too. And then on the services side, we need to look beyond Europe, and we need to think about where are the key barriers in our highly regulated services sectors and say, how can we reduce those barriers? And if you can start thinking about how to align on those different qualifications, then that is something that can actually reduce barriers for our services firms. And that can be a growth strategy. That can be something that can really support the UK economy aligned with our domestic strengths.
I totally agree with Emily that trying to get rid of some of the very large barriers, particularly in professional services, is a great idea and would be potentially a big source of gains for the UK because of its comparative advantage in professional services and does very well in these forms of exports. The problem has always been that in order to be able to make a lot of progress in these areas, then you kind of need to have a shared regulatory system and institutions for coming up with standards and regulations in the services sector that are, you know, both sides are happy with. And so then you end up in these kind of single market type arrangements, which has always proved quite tricky. And so generally, the services bits of free trade agreements and services agreements that are just standalone, as far as I understand the literature, they haven't had a huge impact on the services trade data.
The Labour Party have said that if they're elected, they will pursue the idea of a veterinary agreement with the EU. Now, Nicolo, you mentioned earlier that agri-food was one of the sectors which has been most affected by a reduction in exports to the EU. To what extent do you think a veterinary agreement has the potential to speed up or to enhance UK trade with the EU in that sector?
A regulatory alignment of this sort is likely to have a positive effect on trade, just reduce the burden to producers in terms of paperwork and bureaucracy. And it will facilitate things for UK and EU producers when it comes to bilateral trade.
Well, at this point, we're going to have to move towards wrapping up the podcast. So just as a final question, I'd like to invite you to join me in my TARDIS and kind of leap forward a few years to the year 2030. And we look back and see what's happened to EU-UK trade over that intervening 5 or 6 years. And I'd just like to ask each of you in turn, really, what you think the trade relationship will look like by then. What's your best guess as to where we're going over that period? Emily, can I start with you? What's your best guess as to what the future might hold for the TCA and any potential successor to it?
I think in the near-term horizon, you can see things like the carbon border adjustment mechanism being kind of a leading light in terms of what might happen to UK-EU trade relations. And that is a new tariff that the EU is looking to apply to particular high emitting sectors that it imports from overseas. And that's because the EU already has carbon prices within the EU on those sectors. So to make sure that they stay kind of competitive with the international markets, they are looking to add this CBAM. The UK is also consulting on a CBAM at the moment. We also have an emissions trading scheme, which is similar-ish to the European emissions trading scheme. And it does look like, you know, actually aligning on things like the CBAM, in particularly in those sectors which are high emitting. So steel is a big example of one of those sectors. And it does look like kind of aligning on those things will be beneficial for the UK, as well as for global climate change, which is very important, and also might kind of enable there to be good relations on those particular sectors with the EU. I think over the medium term, however, there needs to be a big reflection in terms of what does the relationship need to look like as you move further and further away from Brexit? You will see increasing regulatory divergence in different pieces of the UK system. And as regulatory divergence happens, then it becomes harder to have those deeper relationships. So you might have particular agreements on sectors like the CBAM, but that's not actually going to have kind of a macroeconomic impact in terms of our growth. So if we do want to have that macroeconomic impact, then we need to think about how do you deepen that EU-UK trade arrangement and where are the key places that you want to deepen it in? And I think that that's kind of a real strategic conversation that we need to be having over the next 5 years.
And John, a lot of this feeds into that concept of sovereignty, that big word that dominated the Brexit debate. Do you see any movements on the balance of interest in that respect over the coming years? Or do you think that that's still going to be a barrier to the kind of deeper trade integration that a lot of business would like to see with the EU?
I think sovereignty is going to continue to be a fairly big issue. I mean, we've already seen that Keir Starmer's ruled out membership or participation in the single market and customs union because there are just some key marginal voters that he feels he needs to win round, and he doesn't want to reopen the Brexit question again. And as Emily says, that means that you're not going to end up with noticeable macroeconomic effects from a renegotiation of the TCA, and you are stuck with a kind of incremental strategy. It is worth remembering that the EU is also quite obsessed with its sovereignty. Even things like trying to negotiate mutual recognition of professional qualifications is quite difficult because that requires the EU to recognise UK systems of professional regulation. And there's a lot of protectionism in this sector. So, you know, Germany doesn't necessarily want British accountants coming and stealing all of their business. And so the Canadian Free Trade Agreement, for example, they had lots of rounds of negotiations and ended up only with architects. So that's just a picture of, you know, some of the dynamics, I think. My hunch is that there will be an attempt to try and do some things, particularly on energy, as Emily raised, potentially on agri-food and potentially on mobility, simply because the EU and Keir Starmer both really want to have a closer relationship for all sorts of other reasons. And so I think it would be difficult for the EU to rebuff the UK entirely because it wants to maintain its right to regulate.
Niccolo, final word from you.
I agree with what Emily and John just said. And I think a lot of what will happen between the UK and the EU will depend on new governments and how the EU and the UK will trust each other. There has been something lacking in the bilateral, you know, political relation over the last few years. And also, we can think that if Brexit will be a less hot topic in the future, perhaps some of the policy that we'll see will be a bit more pragmatic. And we'll try to address the issue directly without having to be sold so vigorously to the public. And for sure, the big questions would be energy and CBAM. And alignment on that side is perhaps warranted. I mean, the EU is the biggest market. And we see something like electric vehicles and batteries. There's been a lot of noise around that. And finally, it seems that some sort of alignment is coming along on that side. So I guess it's election time, and we'll see how things will evolve after December.
Well, time, as they always say, will indeed tell. But there we have to wrap up our podcast for today. So I'd like to say a huge thank you to my excellent guests, Dr. Niccolo Tamberi, Emily Fry, and John Springford. And many thanks to all of you for listening. So do join us again soon for the next episode of Trade Bites. Trade Bites is brought to you by the Centre for Inclusive Trade Policy, supported by the Economic and Social Research Council.